This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Well, we are on the heat of March Madness, and over the decades, I'm sure there have been a number of memorable moments for you. NC State fans, for instance, will remember this.
And with 2 seconds, the kid was able to put it in, and the team of destiny, the Cardiac Kids, North Carolina State, has captured their second NCAA championship to go with 1974's title, 54-52.
And that was 1983 when Jim Valvano and the Wolfpack beat Houston to win the men's NCAA championship game. Journalist Mark Mailer has collected a number of those defining moments in his new book, Madness, the 10 Most Memorable NCAA Basketball Finals. And he joins us now. Mark Mailer, welcome to the State of Things.
Thanks. Excuse me. Thank you, Frank.
Good to have you here. What inspired this book?
Well, my co-author and I, Charlie Pakert, met at a magazine we were working on in the mid-70s, and we both found out, you know, we were lifelong college basketball fans. He's a Syracuse guy. I'm a St. John's guy. He's from Syracuse. I'm from New York. And we just, over the years, watched a lot of these games together, you know, at a bar in the Upper East Side. And I guess Charlie mentioned to me one day in 1990, you know, let's put them together in a book. Let's, you know, do this. And we pitched it to a major publisher in New York. Charlie had a friend over there, and they liked it, but eventually turned it down. And the book sat on a shelf for 25 years. And then we were introduced to a publisher of a specialty sports publisher who loved the idea, and we dusted it off, and here we are.
Well, when you dust it off 25 years later, there's a lot more memorable moments that occur in that 25 years, right?
Not that many.
okay.
Honestly, there's only one chapter in the book, actually, that that occurred since 1991, and that's 2010, Duke Butler. Otherwise, a lot of the games are, you know, in that late 70s to 80s time frame.
And talk about the frame of the book. Obviously, if you're going to name 10 of the most memorable moments, you have to somehow qualify that. They're most important.
Sure.
So how did you qualify it, and what was your filter?
Absolutely. The criteria were these are the most memorable games, not the best. So we really had like four criteria. Obviously, the quality of the game itself, the quality of play, the action, the excitement, all that good stuff. Then it was the impact of these games on the history of the future of college and professional basketball, the impact of these games on social impact of these games, particularly in the civil rights area. And finally, and this is really a key, the iconic personalities who you know took part in those games, the Jim Valvanos, the Dean Smiths, the Bird Magic, and so on.
Yeah, you mentioned two of those North Carolina fans will know about. And in fact, North Carolina figures pretty heavily in this book.
Four chapters highlight North Carolina victories. Yeah, Carolina in 57 and 82, Carolina State in 83. That happens to be my personal favorite chapter, by the way. And, of course, 2010 Duke.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, you remember that game, don't you? Duke fans.
I remember everything past. I don't remember 1957. I was 9 years old.
Okay.
But yeah, I watched the 63 game, Loyola, which is back in the news again, and that's kind of great. And
we'll talk about that Loyola game. That's one that figures in the book, and it's an important when you talk about the social context or something that had social meaning. Talk about that game.
Right. Charlie wrote that particular chapter, but that game in the 1966 Texas Western Kentucky game are really two. Loyola had a coach, George Ireland, who didn't care who he played. He had four black starters. I guess the key thing in that chapter, one of the key things, is the regional between Loyola and Mississippi State, which they call the game of change. Mississippi at the time had a law. They couldn't play against teams with blacks on it. And the Mississippi State administration decided to go ahead anyway and defy the law. And the players and the coaches snuck out of the state of Mississippi to get to East Lansing to play in that game. And it's a heck of a story, a game of change. That's almost, from a civil rights perspective, probably more important than the actual final itself, which was an incredible game.
But that was 1963. And then a game in 1966 also had an important impact.
Right. Absolutely. Texas Western the first time that in the NCAAs that a coach had started five black players, and then, of course, they were playing a team from Kentucky that the entire Southeast Conference was lily white, as were all the conferences south of the Mason-Dixon line. And, you know, so that the all-black, all-white thing, you know, was really what made that. It wasn't a particularly great game at all, but...
No, but things changed. Yeah. We talk about the lily white Southern basketball teams. That was 66. Things changed pretty quickly after that in
Absolutely.
The South.
Absolutely. Within months after that, Perry Wallace became the first black player recruited by the SEC, went to Vanderbilt, and then the floodgates opened up. So in that sense, it was really... It was a very powerful thing, but it did not win the battle for civil rights. It, you know, and I think there's been a lot of hype surrounding that game, and I think I addressed that in the chapter.
Well, talk about what's left undone.
It's a movement. I wrote in the book. It's a movement that's still moving and nowhere near fast enough. Mm, yeah. There's a lot to be done. And I don't think any of the players on Texas Western, and I spoke with virtually all of them, would consider themselves to be heroes in the civil rights struggle. They, but they're proud of what they did. I mean, they were an exceptional group.
Let's talk about some of the other characters in this book. We mentioned these North Carolina teams and figures. You've called Dean Smith one of the greatest college coaches in history. How do you qualify for that? And talk about some others on that list as well. But talk more about Dean Smith.
Well, Dean Smith, you know, along with John Wooden, I guess, is probably the one of the foremost innovators in the game. I mean, let's just think about this for a second. Obviously, the four corners, the use of multiple screens, the run and jump. I mean, he invented a lot of offensive basketball, possession-based analytics. So he was an important figure in terms of the development of the game. He was also a phenomenal coach, a game coach and a human being who had incredible impact on all his players.
Guy named Michael Jordan, you can't probably write a book about the NCAA finals and not talk about him. Tell us about
him. Well, sure. He was a freshman on that 82 team, and he sunk the winning basket. But he was relatively unknown, I guess, except maybe not so much in North Carolina. I actually did see him play in college in the 83 regionals in Syracuse. I didn't speak with Michael in for this book, but he was a key part of that. I mean, there were so many things going on in that game between Georgetown and UNC. So many great personalities, Perkins and James Worthy, Patrick Ewing and John Thompson, coach at Georgetown. I mean, that game was just loaded with important, basketball people.
Well, and there were other games even earlier. I mean, talk about Magic Johnson and Larry Bird, that championship.
Can't leave that game out. As a game, it was probably the worst game of the 10. But I think every chapter in this book, this occurred to me before I was doing an interview with a radio station in Denver. It occurred to me that each one, although they're unique stories in and of themselves, they're all love stories. In a sense, mostly love stories between coaches and their players, like the Valvano team in 83. The Magic Bird thing is an unusual love story because it's a love story between players on opposing teams. They may not have loved each other when they played that game, but they came to later. And what Magic and Larry did for the game of basketball makes that chapter absolutely essential to having the book.
You talked about Jimmy V and that championship for NC State, but you also talk about Jimmy Valvano as a coach and as his relationship with his players as a real team leader. Tell us more about that and how big a role that played.
I think one of the sources I spoke to was a SID, a sports information director at a school out in the West, and he invited Valvano to come and speak at the school to revive interest in reinstating the basketball program. He said, when the guy talked to you, when he listened to you, it made you feel like you were the most important person in the world. And I think that's really what Valvano did for every one of those kids. He made them feel they could accomplish anything if they just believed in him, believed in him. Mm. And along with that faith, I think, again, came the love I was talking about. That was a very, very special team and a very special coach at a very special moment in time. It is my, hands down favorite chapter in the book. I wish I could have spent a few hours with Jimmy V in a bar just drinking and talking. It would have been great.
I don't personally follow the game very closely, but it does seem to me that given the fact that young players or players come out so quickly now, and they very rarely, the best players rarely even go 4 years, that coaching, it would seem to me, just on the basis of that, at the college level, is far more important even than it is in the pros, because the very best, you can't keep the very best players, right? You see, you're working with players who are not, well, by some definition anyway, not if they're seniors, not the very, very best. Now, they may not pan out that way, but you see what I'm saying. Is that true, do you think? Do you think coaching plays a bigger part in college ball?
I think it does, yeah. I mean, they're kids. Yeah. And I think the relationships, the personal relationships, Dean Smith had that. I mean, if you listen, you know, it was a lot more than just X's and O's. I don't think that people like, you know, coaches like Valvano and Smith could have had the success they had. You didn't have time to teach. I mean, in the Valvano case, he had 3 years, you know, with those kids. The first couple of years, first year they were mediocre. Second year they were okay. They were pretty good. By the third year they had fully grasped what he was saying and had really integrated that dream into their psyches, you know, and they were ready to win.
It seems to be even tougher now as these players don't even go the 4 years, right? You don't even have 3 years with some of them.
So absolutely.
You've got to figure out a way to get it through and have them and perhaps play like a team. I suppose that might be a difference between the pros and college. As I say, you probably follow it closely, more closely than I do. Big game tonight. Your partner, your writing partner, Syracuse fan. There's some folks around here who will be on his side. That would be Carolina fans who will be certainly rooting for Syracuse tonight. On the other hand, a lot of Duke fans. Hoping your partner has a bad night.
he couldn't be with us today. He has a full-time job, actually. I'm semi-retired.
Yeah.
But he's in 1987 when Syracuse lost. I think that chapter is not in the book, but 1987 when Indiana beat Syracuse on a basket at the buzzer, right? Charlie pretty much went through the roof. I mean, I think he hit the roof with his head.
There were some Carolina fans who went the other way when they played Michigan and thought for sure they were going to lose until Chris Webber called this timeout. Let's listen to this.
Webber brings it into the front court. They have no timeouts remaining.
Oh, he causes too many timeouts. That's a technical foul.
He called a timeout. Michigan doesn't have any.
He takes the timeout. Technical foul. Timeout. Technical foul. Technical foul.
It was a technical foul.
we originally had that chapter in as one of the 10, and then we went through this whole process, of weaning. But we did throw in a chapter 11, which tells shorter versions of five games that narrowly missed the cut, and the 93 game is in there.
You talk about Wilt Chamberlain, now star player for Kansas, obviously a star player in the NBA, expected to beat Carolina back in 57 and didn't. And you say that that's something that Wilt Chamberlain carried with him for the rest of his life.
Yeah, it's true. Again, Charlie wrote that particular chapter, but I think it really came to his defense. He played a great game, and the other four guys on Kansas did not play well, did not shoot well. Wilt did what he was, what he was trained to do, what he was supposed to do. It was not his fault. Let me put it that way. Just a great player, and I think a fundamentally decent guy. Left us too soon. Yeah.
Yeah, but let me ask you this. I mean, it doesn't seem to me that. Is this something that he really did have to sort of try to live down because he had a pretty good career?
Yeah, I really wonder. I have no way of knowing how much that really bothered him. I think he kind of thought of things a little bit differently. I think he had more in his mind than that, and he was in some ways soft, I guess you could say. I think he had more going on in his head than just winning basketball games.
What do you make of this year? I mean, Carolina's out, Virginia's out, the brackets are ruined,
It's madness.
That's why they call it madness, right?
it's madness. Right. This is really a crazy year. My pick was Villanova. They're still in there. But I don't think there's one bracket in the whole world that hasn't been busted.
What do you think about the game itself? I mean, you know, with all of the scandals around sports programs, collegiate sports programs, everybody, especially sports boosters, will try to say, this is the pure game. This is real competition. And certainly with March Madness, the kind of frenzy you get over the tribal spirit that goes into all of this makes it seem like it's something more authentic. But what do you think? I mean, are we losing something here?
Well, there's the game of basketball and the business of Division I college basketball, and those are two different things. And I had to go back after the indictments were handed down, I guess, was it late last year, go back and just do a little rewrite of the introduction just to, you know, to reference the indictments and reference the fact that there is a dark web, of college basketball. And it's big money. It's billions of dollars, and sneaker money and all kinds of money, television money. And I felt we needed to at least have a few paragraphs in the introduction addressing the fact that we're not oblivious to that. But basically, these are stories of 10 games. And the beauty of the game, I mean, I think it's a more beautiful game now than it was, in 1950.
What makes it that way? Why do you say that?
Well, the quality of the play, the speed, all the innovations that have come, the development of the high post, John Wooden developing the high post and the high-low post offenses, all the things we talked about with Dean Smith. When you watch the game played the way it's supposed to be played, it's a beautiful thing. When you watch Wooden's high post offense, work, it's like a ballet. It's an exquisite thing to watch. That's immutable. I mean, that's just there.
Do you think college players should be paid?
I think you have to begin to treat college student athletes, whatever you call them, the way you might treat a violinist, a scholarship violinist, or a scholarship English major. Let them go out and sign autographs and make money and just don't treat them, special.
Yeah, because it seems to me, if you're talking about a game that's improved a lot, and largely because of some of the innovations in the game, but also because the players are playing at a higher level, part of that has to do with the money, at least the incentive at the NBA level, but also the money that goes into these programs. So you think maybe it's a double-edged sword, and if, the students could just take, benefit by some of that, then you'd have the excellence in the game and the right people benefiting. Anyway, yeah, that's the argument.
If you start paying players, I mean, then what is that? Is that part of the college now? Or, do they still have to go to school? Or what are that? Are they professional players within the college? I'm not sure. I mean, I've read a lot of things and, excuse me, there's a slippery slope there.
Yeah. What was your biggest moment in this book? The two of you put this book together. What was your favorite moment?
You mean
in the book?
I think it was 83, as I think I said. But it's all great. I mean, writing about Dean Smith was a pleasure. The challenge was really, particularly for the chapters I wrote, there is an awful lot written already, and documentaries and magazine articles and books. Half the people I spoke with wrote books of their own. To find a fresh way to tell these stories. And for me, the challenge of doing that was probably, was great. It was a good challenge. I welcomed it.
Mark Mailer, a journalist and co-author of the book Madness, the 10 Most Memorable NCAA Basketball Finals, joins us from the studios of Radio Foundation in New York. Mark, thanks so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Just ahead, we talk with a band and we hear some music, the music of Cosmic Punk, live on the State of Things. Stay tuned.